Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith.
I am so excited because this person, Janice Selby, has been a consistent guest and always brings just fantastic discussions and topics to RFRX. So as a registered professional counselor with a personal history of religious trauma, Janice is passionate about helping others understand their losses and to embrace their new identity in a secular world. Boy, I tell you what, when I was coming out about 11 years ago, I could have used someone to help guide me through. So she's fantastic for that. Her own deconversion experience compelled her to develop the online Divorcing Religion Workshop. And that's a six-week interactive workshop combining written exercises and group work to bring together those from diverse backgrounds who are walking a similar journey. And I'll also let you know, she and the secular mom has started up a podcast that they record every Sunday, and they talk about secular parenting. So Janice, welcome once again for your 432nd time. I'm so glad that you're here.
It's such a pleasure to be here, and you almost got it correct. My podcast is with Godless Mom, and it's called the Godless Moms Podcast, and it happens on Saturdays, noontime PST, and it is all about secular parenting. So thanks for bringing that up, because I forgot.
Sure, I was talking to the folks in Australia, so for them.
Oh. Okay, good save, yeah.
I know, right? So Janice, how are you doing? And welcome back.
Thank you. I am incredibly, incredibly busy right now, not just with the podcast, but because I'm getting ready to host the inaugural conference on religious trauma. And our beloved Dr. Daryl Ray is one of our keynote speakers who's going to be speaking at the online conference on religious trauma. And so let me tell you, it takes a lot of work to put this conference together. If you ever think you want to put a conference together, give me a call and I'll quickly talk you out of it, because it is so much work.
Same.
But it's going to be really good, because we not only have the experts in the field of religious trauma, but also a lot of people who have walked through religious trauma themselves, people from different backgrounds. We have a person who was an Orthodox Jew and one who was a Muslim, and of course many, many who were Christians, and they will be talking about their own experiences, and people will be offering ideas, what worked for them. I think it's just going to be a great opportunity for people to learn. So I'm looking forward to it.
Is this going to be virtual or in person?
Well, I was putting it together a couple years ago to be in person.
Right.
I'm Canadian. I live in British Columbia. And so we were going to have the conference in the beautiful city of Vancouver, but you know, coronavirus. So instead we're having it online, and this will be in May. And actually, any of the folks who are watching or listening to this, if they'd like to register and get a discount, they can use the discount code POD15 when they register, and that'll give them a discount. So I want as many people to be able to attend as possible. And also, you can buy a ticket. If it seems too much money to buy the full access ticket, you can buy a ticket only for the recordings. And that's about half price. So we're trying to offer something for everybody.
That's excellent. And I know that you've been working super hard on this. And I remember last year how hard you had worked on it, and then stupid COVID hit, and you had to really, I mean, it was so disheartening and sad, because I know how hard you had worked on it, and you had to cancel, or it had to be canceled. And
it was like really going 400 miles an hour and running into a brick wall. Just everything came to just this screeching halt, and with so much uncertainty, like, because we didn't know at the beginning of the pandemic what's it going to be like, what's going to happen, how's life going to change. And I'm sure my postponement or cancellation was just one of many that had to happen as a result of that. So it was a hard time. It was an ending for me, and I had to cope with it. We're going to be talking today about beginnings and endings and beginnings again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Janice, because I know you're super, super busy now with, you know, the work that you do in the workshop and the podcast and everything. So we are so grateful that you got the time to tell us a bit about beginnings and transitions and how to deal with them. Because, I mean, the pandemic is just one of the many examples of how to deal with a new beginning and a new world and, you know, all of that. So how do we start with this topic? I know it's quite broad, it's quite abstract, but what would be the first step?
Well, I have a quote that I really like, and it's that new beginnings are often disguised as painful endings. And that has been so true for me. And I mean, truly, life is a series of beginnings and endings right from the time we're born until the time we're done. But when I think of the ones in my own life that made such a significant impact, there were times that really separated my life into before and after, because the transitions were so massive. And sometimes we welcome transition, we expect it. I mean, when we're coming into adulthood, we're excited about that and things that'll come with it, or becoming a parent, or, you know, a career advancement, things like that. But some transitions are unwanted and unexpected, and those tend to be the ones that we find more traumatizing. So I had been married for a couple of decades, and then around the end time of my marriage, one of my children was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness, and that was really what made me stop and question everything I'd been taught religiously, because I was quite a devout fundamentalist Christian person. I was married to a pastor, and very conservative, homeschooled my children and, you know, all these things, and really tried so hard to live a holy life. And then all of a sudden my kid receives this horrifying diagnosis, and that changed my life immediately. And then as I began to question and allow myself to start doing some research, then I found that my faith couldn't stand the test. So everything my entire identity that I built my life around, this faith, now that had dissolved. And then, so the marriage, the loss of the marriage came next after that. So this was boom, 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 just a series of huge losses. And it takes time to process those losses and to kind of figure out logical next steps and how can a new beginning come. And then for me, a new beginning came when I entered into another relationship, and it was my first relationship in many years, because I'd been married for about 20 years, but and it was, you know, a secular relationship. So let me tell you, dating changed a lot in 20 years, and with the advent of the internet. So dating was quite an exercise. And then I found someone that I thought was stable, and we started to build a beautiful life together, and I was having a wonderful new beginning. I went back to school. That's when I did my counseling schooling, And things were just looking so good and feeling so good. And my partner owned a luxury travel company. So guess what? All of a sudden, and there was no pandemic, traveling to exotic places around the world that I had never traveled to. And this person had quite a bit of money. That was also something that was new for me. I got used to it pretty quick. But then unexpectedly, bam, came the ending to that. I thought, I mean, we were living together and we were talking about marriage, and then suddenly, bam, nope, he wanted out. He was seeing someone else on the side, which I didn't know about. So there was that betrayal. There was the loss of trust and hope, and even the loss of innocence, because I hadn't been betrayed in my marriage. My marriage was fairly stable. So to suddenly have that massive ending come when things just looked so beautiful, and it was really, it hit me really hard. I really grieved that relationship, and it took me quite a while to find my feet after that. But eventually I did. You know, I moved out on my own and was trying to rebuild from there. And then guess what? I met someone else and then started that new relationship. So there's another beginning. And I just thought this person was just, well, let's just say this person was too good to be true. And you know what? They were too good to be true. So after a few years with this person and building a new life and things moving forward, you know, I developed my divorce and religion workshop. When I was with this person, there was stability there. I started working on the conference on religious trauma. So really trying to take steps forward in my life. And then we already talked about, bam, came the pandemic. And so at that time, my partner that I was living with was working in another province. So he was just coming home every, you know, month or so. And when I had to postpone the conference, and I sent him a message because I needed some comforting because I was really sad about having to postpone it, he sent me a message back and said, well, I can't be in this relationship anymore. And then I found out, as I was trying to refund money for the tickets, he had been pilfering money. He had been stealing the money from the account.
What?
Yes, yes. So then I had to start borrowing money from relatives and trying to pay off all these people. It was extremely traumatic, and I felt that my reputation would suffer as a result. So then there's the pandemic. I've had to cancel my conference. I've lost this person in my life that I loved very deeply. And then I got a text from my landlord, and we had my youngest daughter and the partner and I had all been living together.
Oh, no.
And the text was,
but wait, there's more.
Oh my God. Yeah. So much more. The text was, you're being evicted. You have been late on rent 3 times. And in British Columbia, that means you're evicted. I had no idea, because I always gave my portion of rent to my partner, who then paid the landlords, and I never heard from them that it was late. So now it's a pandemic, and my child is immune compromised, and we are being evicted in the middle of this.
That's awful.
I know. It was crazy. You can't make this shit up. So this all happened in like a span of weeks, just weeks. And it was so hard for me even to catch my breath. Where am I going to look for comfort? How am I going to get through this? And I'm still trying to, you know, I was trying to pay people back and come up with money. And so that was, when I think about painful endings, that was just a huge whack of painful endings all wrapped up together. It was really, really hard. And I had to, I mean, I leaned on my family as much as I dared, financially and also emotionally. But my family had also loved this person, so they also felt deeply betrayed. But by the way, let me tell you, then I got a phone call from my partner's wife saying that they actually weren't divorced. He was still married to her the whole time. He was living a double life with me for 3 years. I know. Somebody write this down. It should be a movie.
I know. You should write a book about it. Jesus
exactly.
Christ.
Wow.
It was very painful. So it was betrayal on betrayal and heartache on heartache. And so my family also was just feeling so sad and betrayed because we had all really opened our hearts to this person. As I say, he seemed so wonderful and so helpful. So everybody was kind of grieving that loss. But my mental health, I was concerned. I did have to reach out for help because I needed extra support. How am I going to get through this? So then I thought, okay, I have to find another place to live. But then, of course, you have to fill out rental applications. They all want to know why you're leaving your current place. And I was being evicted because my partner had not paid the rent on time. And so it was just a lot of difficulty. And then a very loving relative offered to help me secure a down payment for a mobile home. And so then I wouldn't ever have to, you know, rent again and be in such a predicament again. So then started the process of looking for a place and trying to get okayed for a mortgage and all this stuff. And so my part of my new beginning that came out of that very painful ending is for the first time ever, I get to be a homeowner. I get to actually have a home that I can call my own. And this has just been, it's been such a weight lifted off me. So we're having all these endings, and then there are new beginnings too. And then a friend that I'd known for a couple of years really started reaching out to me. We were internet friends. We met in a common themed group online, and so we saw each other often that way on Zoom calls and so forth. And then that person saw what was going on because I was having to be public about it. As I was trying to tell people, please be patient while I do my best to find money to pay you back, pay you off your ticket money. And this person was so concerned for me and just so such a good solid friend, and really came in to support me at a time when I absolutely needed it. And then after a number of months went by, this person, now we were both single because we had never ever considered any kind of relationship before. We were just very good friends. And then the person said, you know, when you do ever think that you might be interested in dating again, I hope you'll consider me. And that was such a surprise.
That sounds like a high school thing. Oh my God, I was like,
that's lovely.
Are you going to the homecoming?
I want to go out.
And wait. Did he send you a note where there's like a box of yes and a box that said no, and you had to check one of them?
He did. He did not. But I decided when I felt ready, I decided I was going to go for it again, even though I've had my heart broken again and again. And what it has done for me is made me more careful, make sure that I have my eyes wide open. This person, I know other people in real life who know this person. We have common friends. And so that has been also a tremendous help in building trust.
Was that something that you was like out of these experiences that you've shared with us, was that something that started to erode away? Was your trust in other people too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
It really, really did. And even so with the loss of my faith, even my trust in myself was eroded to a degree, because I thought, yeah. I believed that for like 40 years. 40 years I believed it. What does that say about me that I would spend so long, so deeply attached to something, only then to eventually come to the conclusion that it's actually not what I thought it was, or it's not true, or I mistook mythology for reality. So what was helpful for me partly in that was around the time that I started going to school to become a counselor. And so you're expected to do a lot of introspective work and try and figure out yourself. If you're going to be able to help other people, you have to be in a position yourself where you're, you know, pretty much have some things taken care of. And that's why all good mental health clinicians have their own mental health clinicians. We have to have other people that we can talk to when we're struggling. And in the pandemic, so many people are struggling and needing help. And then it's extra important for us to be able to reach out to our own colleagues and get support that way too. So yeah, my trust was definitely eroded. And in this new relationship, we have both just made a real point of taking it very slowly. And it does help that he lives in the United States. So even if we wanted to go faster, we couldn't really go much faster because there's like thousands of miles in between us. and, you know, the borders are still closed, but they'll be open one day. So then we can see what the relationship looks like once we are actually able to spend time together with each other. So
glad that it has like a bit of a happy ending, because you went through so many things, and especially during a pandemic, like that's the least you need. I feel like even if you have the most stable, quote unquote, perfect life, a pandemic is just, it just destabilizes you completely. But on top of that, you had all of those like experiences. Yeah, I'm so sorry you had to go through that. And I'm so glad that, you know, you saw the light at the end of the tunnel. And
thank
that there's hope there.
Yes. And, you know, it's also different going through tough transitions when you're not religious anymore, because I had been such a religious person and my faith was so important to me. And I always had believed that no matter what went on, there was a purpose to it. God was strengthening me or chastening me or doing whatever. Everything was for my own good. Well, then when your kid gets so sick that they could die, that's when I really stopped to think, no, I don't think so. I don't want any part of any religion that has a God that would afflict a child with a disease like that. Or going through tough transitions when you don't have your faith anymore is even harder because you don't have that to lean on. But I became so aware of my incredible strength. I had no idea, absolutely no idea how strong I am and exactly what I can endure. And I say that to everybody who's watching or listening today. You have managed to survive every single freaking thing that has come your way so far. You've made it. You've made it. You're still here. You're still standing. And that deserves some recognition. And sometimes that's helpful. When we're in the midst of another really tough and unwanted transition, it can be helpful to look back over life and see all the things that we have made it through so far. Like, I never thought I'd survive this or that, or I remember that really hard time and then I was divorced and I didn't know how I could ever make it. And then, you know, I lost all the money because my partner had taken it, and people stepped in to help me. And sometimes I had to ask for that help. We have to be willing to ask for help when we need it, and it can be very hard. And sometimes I didn't need to ask for the help. What I did have to be all the time was quite honest, very brutally honest with myself and with other people about what was going on. And that doesn't mean you have to tell people like every gory detail. You get to decide how much to share, but it is important to maintain your integrity and your honesty. And everybody screws up sometime. Everybody makes a poor choice that comes around to bite them in the butt. That's part of being human. And nobody is above that. And if somebody tells you they've never made a mistake, they're lying or they're remembering it differently. So
now,
that's true.
You kind of opened up your story with a quote. Would you mind bookending it with that same quote so we can kind of hear the impact of it for you?
You mean you want to hear the quote again?
Please. Yeah.
New beginnings are often disguised as painful endings. And that has just been so true for me. And I love my new beginnings. I've loved them every time. I haven't so much loved the painful endings. But I find beginnings hopeful and exciting. And there's terrain that we go through to get to that point where it feels hopeful. There's an author named Dr. Elizabeth Harper Neild, and she wrote this book. It's called Tough Transitions. It's a book called Tough Transitions. And in her book, Dr. Harper Neild talks about the terrain of tough transitions, and she talks about responding. And so that's when something has just really happened to us and we're trying to figure out what's going on. We're trying to catch our breath. Our emotions are haywire. Our emotions are numb. The transition's out of control. That's when we're in the responding phase. Then we move to the reviewing phase. And it's important that we look after our health in that time. And that's a time when we're reminiscing and we're strong enough to start questioning, like what exactly happened and why did that happen? And also in the reviewing state is a time where we can start getting rid of outdated things that we don't need anymore. The next step she moves on to is reorganizing. That's when we're starting to figure out our new identity. And that actually can be really fun. It can be scary when we lose everything that we thought we were. I mean, I was no longer a Christian, but I was also no longer a wife. I was no longer a homeschooling mom because I had to go back to work in order to pay, to live my life. So all these aspects of my identity that had been so central were gone. They totally dissolved. So I got to figure out, well, who am I really? And who do I want to be? So that's part of the reorganizing. And one way that Dr. Harper Neild puts it that I really like it, she says, in the reorganizing phase, that's when we are retrieving threads of meaning and purpose from our old life. What is back there that still I value and that I want to bring with me into my new life? That's an important thing to think about. And then the final step that she talks about is renewing. And it's where life is in the new normal. It's where we have more energy now to be creative. We're getting new ideas and hopefully we're thriving. And that's where I feel I'm at now. I've been able to move from a traumatized victim to a survivor to someone who's thriving in my new life. And I just keep freaking going. I just keep going. I mean, fall down 7 times, get up 8. And sometimes it takes me longer to get back up. And sometimes I don't want to get back up. Sometimes I'm really hurting and I'm really tired and I'd just rather stay down. And that's when, we really need to marshal our troops. That's when we need to be reaching out for extra help, especially for mental health help when we're feeling kind of that we're in that pit. I think it's important for people to invest in themselves. Invest in yourself however you can. And investing in yourself might mean that you start to eat better, or that you start taking time for exercise, or that you start taking a course here and there on the internet. It might mean that you decide to put yourself out there in the dating world again. Investing in yourself. Yes. And I see someone that says a hobby that you love. Yes. Investing in your personal growth. That's so important. That's part of how we're moving into a healthier place. And we're also shoring up our own degree of resilience, because one thing I can tell you is something's going to happen again. I mean, we don't just stay in like this peaceful state. There are wonderful things that happen, and there are terrible things that happen. And that's part of being human. One thing Winston Churchill said was, success is not final and failure is not final. It's the courage to continue that counts. And I find that to be true. You just have to, have the courage to keep on going and keep on growing.
One of the things that I see often with some of my old religious communities is people who are struggling, even struggling with some really tough situations like alcohol or drug abuse, or even domestic violence. And they are, I'm meeting them kind of on the other side of it, and they're sharing with me this story. And they say, you know, if it wasn't for God, if it wasn't for Jesus, I wouldn't be here today. And I kind of am thinking and looking at them, this was you. This is the strength that you had. This is the community that you had that stepped in to help you out. If I was to say like Jesus or God did this for me, it robs me of the opportunity to experience how brave and courageous and triumphant I was and my community was. And instead it just kind of shoves it off into somewhere else that can't appreciate it and doesn't understand it. And and I've always, like, after coming out of or deconverting, coming out of my own religion, I've always have kind of seen it that way. It's like, no, this wasn't a deity, this wasn't a god, this was you, this was your courage and strength that got you through it.
I totally agree. And that's a frustration, particularly looking at people who get trapped in addiction and addictive behaviors. And then so many churches, of course, love to host various recovery groups. And so often what happens is people are just encouraged to swap one addiction for another. So they're not going to be drinking or doing drugs anymore, but they are very addicted to Jesus, and they had better be in church, you know, however many times or whatever it is, and be sure to give God all the glory. And there are AA groups actually that are atheists, like there are secular AA groups, which I didn't know. And one thing I encourage my clients to do instead is to pursue SMART recovery, S-M-A-R-T.
Right. Yeah.
SMART recovery. And that's really, to me, I feel like that's a more empowering position for people to be in.
We're actually going to have an RFRX session about this exact topic, about SMART recovery, in 2 weeks. So perfect. If anyone listening is interested, in 2 weeks we're going to have just a wonderful speaker speaking about the SMART model.
That's terrific, particularly because I think coming out of the pandemic, when we're on the other side of this, we are going to have a lot of people with a lot more addictions. That's, people are trying to cope, and that's one way, unfortunately, that is familiar to people to try and cope is by drinking or drugging to try and numb the pain or the boredom or whatever it is they're coping with. So I'm delighted that you're going to be having a guest talking about SMART recovery. That's so cool. I think that's an important point that you made, Eric.
And it almost seems like if I were to kind of give all of the acknowledgement of my achievement to a God. It almost seems like I'm playing a victim in some sense, whereas opposed, if I took on the responsibility, yes, I was addicted, but yes, I got out of this. I'm a survivor, and I'm a warrior, and I'm strong and courageous. It just feels so much more empowering to do it that way.
100%. And that's one of the reasons that I chose some of the questions for our poll, because I want people to think about, did religion actually prepare them, like, for real life, for times when you just seem to get shat upon over and over again, like happened to me in the last year? No, religion did not do anything particularly to help me cope with that. And then even did my family of origin do anything to help me deal with betrayal? Not especially, and partly because my family of origin was very religious, and also because they had never been through what I had been through. But my point there is that when we grieve, because when we have losses, we do enter a kind of a time of mourning, we tend to grieve how it was modeled for us in our family of origin. And often it's not modeled at all. That, you know, our parents don't talk about it, or they don't want us to know about it. I have the opposite idea. If you're going through something, you can share it with your kids to the age appropriate level, right? We don't want to be burdening our children, but it's okay for our kids to see that mom and dad, or mom or dad, or auntie, whoever it is, we do have struggles. This is part of real life, and we can be modeling resilience to them. You know, if your little one is trying to pour themselves a glass of milk and they knock it over and it's all over the floor, then you're going to get a rag with them and get the little one down on the floor and you're going to show them, now this is what we do when we spill milk. We just clean it up, and then we can go on right on with our day. And it's okay. And you know, it's not a bad life, it's just a bad day, that kind of idea. And we need to really remind ourselves of that sometimes, because it's so easy to get into that. Oh, everything's terrible, everything's awful. Sometimes things are terrible and awful, but spring is still going to come. The day follows the night. We are not going to be stuck here forever in this pandemic.
Do you have any advice to gain resilience? Because I believe that's like a skill that you can work on. And we may not have been taught that as a child. I'm sure in many religious communities it's not taught at all. So do you have any advice for anyone who's maybe in that situation where they want to work on their resilience, but it's very difficult because, you know, life happens?
Yeah, it sure does. I always encourage people to do their research. So if someone wants to learn about resilience, you better start Googling and learn about, you can find out stories of other people who have been able to harness resilience so that they've been able to overcome tragedy and trauma and move to a more of a triumphant kind of state. And especially when we have children, we do, like you say, it is a skill. We want to be encouraging them in the area of resilience. So part of that is encouraging them to try new things, and we're encouraging ourselves to try new things too, and recognizing that not every new thing is going to be our thing. You know, we're going to try, and sometimes we're going to just fall flat on our face. That's just the way it goes. Some people are more gifted in other areas than others are. But we can help them then, if we're talking about our children, we can talk about what do they think went wrong? Do they have any insight on why, how it might have gone differently? Mm-hmm. Or what if they made this choice? Or what if they made that choice? And so it's just a very warm and loving and compassionate and encouraging conversation. And we can do this with our children. We can also do it with ourselves. So not not beating ourselves up. I should have done it different. I knew I shouldn't have trusted that guy, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? You did trust that person. And now here's the situation that you're in. So instead of staying stuck there, let's try and figure out what's our next step. We're going to be honest with ourselves about where we're at, and we're trying to survey the landscape, look around and see, okay, what makes sense as a next step? And sometimes we have to consult somebody else, maybe who's been there, who's had experience with what we're dealing with, and they can try and help us map out potential next steps. And you know, I think, sorry, go on.
You kind of bring up a really good point about being okay with making mistakes, because for whatever reason, I'm wired to think like I'm supposed to do things perfectly in life. And I get down on myself so hard when I make a mistake. I'm getting better and better as I'm getting older, but I can look back in my 20s and my 30s, yes. But I was so embarrassed of the mistakes I made, and I kept that on for so long, and it just gave me this sense of anger and frustration and regret when I kind of look back on the mistakes that I made in the past, and I didn't feel like I was able to kind of grow from that and go beyond it for a long while until I acknowledged that it was okay to make a mistake.
And we tend to be like Velcro for negative thoughts. Boy, we collect those so easy and they stick to us so easy. And we tend to be like Teflon for when the good things happen or when we accomplish something or whatever, just kind of like drops right off. And we want to try and reverse that, right? We want to try and get to the point where we're like Teflon for self-criticism, you know, but instead, and that we're like Velcro for really acknowledging and looking at the wonderful things that we've been able to accomplish. We really need to try and work on flipping that around and being kind to ourselves. And that's also where it can be helpful to talk with someone you know, because it's easy for our thinking to become distorted, especially when we're kind of under that cloud of depression. And talking to someone else, they maybe can remind us, I watched you walk through such and such situation with dignity and grace, or I remember when you really struggled, but you sure found your way through. Find trustworthy people to depend on and surround yourself with in your life. And sadly, there will come times when those really great people disappoint you because they are human too. But the point is to try and surround yourself with healthy people to the best of your ability, because they are going to contribute to your resilience when you have that community support there. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I had to kind of go through that firsthand and very with a very close, like my father. I looked up to him. I respected him. I learned so much from him. But as I grew older, my father suddenly became human. And he did some horrible things and treated the people that I cared about awfully. And so it kind of came down to a moment for me where I asked myself, and I think I've shared this before in some other archives, where I asked myself, If this guy wasn't my father and I just met him in a random bar or whatever, after we talked, would I want to hang out with him again? And the answer was no. I was honest with myself and the answer was no, I wouldn't want to hang out with this guy again. And what was interesting is it helped me kind of let go of him. And because before I had gone back to him, like, all right, let's go to counseling, let's try to work on this relationship, back and forth, and then you continue to betray me and betray my mother and my wife, and got to this point where I finally asked myself that question, and it really helped. One of the things I recognize out of it is that I was living in this fantasy expectation of like the father is always going to be there for you and he's always going to love you and that's his job. But then he became human and I was able to set that fantasy aside, let that go, and not necessarily put that expectation on him, but also be okay with stepping away. It wasn't an overnight thing. Mm-hmm. I'm in my 40s and this happened in, the teens and 20s. It took a decade or more to get through it, but I'm okay with it now. And I'm glad to not have him as this negative influence and toxic, poisonous person in my life.
Yeah. And that it really also demonstrates the toxic theology that many of us were experienced in the church, just kind of living with rose-colored glasses perpetually on. I have to forgive them. It'll get better. Mean it, whatever it is. There comes a point for our own health where we actually need to take stock. If someone has betrayed us and the wound is so deep, take a look if there's a pattern in your life and your relationship with this person. Has this been happening over and over again and your religious training or the training from your parents just has you, bent into a pretzel trying to forgive all the time? So I'm going to tell you a couple things that people might find shocking. You're under no obligation to forgive anyone ever. It is your choice.
Wait, what?
Whether to.
but there's people who ask us for forgiveness. Yeah, don't we have to?
And you get to decide whether you care to do it. It's your wound. It's your choice. It's your power. And abusers often weaponize the concept of forgiveness. So I'll say you don't have to forgive people. And the second thing that I hope is liberating for someone today, because it sure was liberating to me when I came to this conclusion. Once you become an adult, your parents remain in your life by invitation only. They do not have a right to be there. You are not.
Oh my God, Janice!
To maintain
every single time.
yeah.
Can so you say that again, please,
that and think
for the
about
people in
that.
The back.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Your parents are in your life by invitation only now that you are an adult, and you get to decide whether your life is better and whether your children's lives are better by your parents having such access to you. And if you become estranged, if you make that decision that there needs to be greater distance or you may have to cut them off entirely, that does not make you a bad person. That makes you a person who is choosing your mental health over the feelings of someone who is probably fairly unhealthy. And that's why it's come to this point. So I hope that's helpful to someone out there today, because that's such a heavy burden, feeling
you
have to forgive people or always keep toxic relatives around. You don't. It's great news. You don't.
That is one of the most beautiful things and most applicable things to my own life. Like, not only has it just totally solidified the decision I made back in my 20s, but I'm going through something difficult now and just now. And I have never thought of it that way. And I'm so grateful that you said something like that. Good. Janice, the check is in the mail. I'm sending you... I don't know, 250 bucks or 600 bucks, whatever you're worth. This was amazing.
Yay. Oh, I'm so glad. I love coming on here. Thanks, you guys. It's been a real pleasure to be here on your one-year anniversary. I feel so excited that I was the guest that got to come on here for that.
I think you have been the guest that has come the more times, if I'm not wrong. So, I mean, it's only, you could be the only one to be here today, Janice. I mean, and we didn't even plan it. It just happened that today was the 1-year anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Worked out beautifully.
You had mentioned about weaponizing forgiveness. Mm. Do you have any examples of that, or do you mind expanding on that a little bit more? Because I've begun to somewhat identify it in my own life, but I think that would be kind of helpful for. All right, I'll be selfish. That'd be helpful for me. If anybody else isn't helped by it, that's okay. But do you have any examples?
I think it actually comes up sadly frequently within religious situations and religious institutions. So we know that predators are absolutely drawn to positions of power. And so religious and spiritual groups are really attractive to predators, because they know that the people in that group probably are going to be very obedient, and they can also threaten them with hell or damnation, or that they'll be cast out of the group or whatever. So then a predator or an abuser violates a person, violates a trust in some way, and then they also use that spiritual emphasis to say, but you have to forgive me. The Bible says, God commands, you have to forgive or you won't be forgiven. So that's really where the weaponization comes in. And it's just absolutely not true. You don't have to. And if someone is telling you that you must forgive them, you really need to take a look at that person and that relationship.
I've been on this planet for over 40 years, and I'm just now beginning to recognize it. It is something that doesn't seem to come natural to me but it also may stem back to my own raising as in the Christian faith, where I was taught to be Christ-like. I was taught to to take on the aspects that the characteristics that God would have. I mean, for crying out loud, within that belief system, a child molester can molest children up until the day they die and ask forgiveness in the final moments, and they will be forgiven. And people like me, or people who may have a tendency to be abused, just will glom onto that and expect maybe that forgiving this person, it'll be better. And I mean, I'm probably way off, but is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think we're conditioned either in our family of origin. So certainly in my family of origin, not only was religion a factor, but one parent was a diagnosed narcissist, and the other one was extremely codependent. And that is usually how it happens. That's a dynamic between narcissists and codependents very frequently. And then also, it was the time that my parents grew up in. So yeah, my dad was the narcissist, and he expected my mom to do everything and expected us to be perfect and whatever the situation was. And so I watched her my whole life growing up bend over backwards to placate this man. She literally burned out her health trying to serve this man who was a bottomless pit. He could never be filled. And so that's kind of where I saw her forgive him over and over and over again. And I thought it was crazy, because then he should change his behavior. If he truly was sorry, he would think that he would change his behavior. Right. And she still lives her life that way. My mom, that's the way she chooses to live. I'm now estranged from my dad, even though I'm a therapist. I made that choice myself of, okay, that relationship's got to go. I don't have to keep trying. My life is infinitely healthier now without that person in it. And sometimes I feel like we struggle the most with forgiveness towards ourselves. Like when I left the faith, I really I really left the faith. And my kids were just in their teens, and they saw me go from being like totally restricted and constricted and uptight to be like, oh my God, there's no rules. Mom has totally lost her mind. She's going crazy. We're going to have to go bail her out of jail. Like, what's happening? And so then,
why does she have this new Harley motorcycle in here?
That's right. Got all these tattoos. And so I just went one direction to the other direction. And then when I finally, you know, found my feet and aimed more towards the middle again, which is the healthier ground, I had to be able to forgive myself and recognize this was all a growth process, and growth is the end product of growth might be pretty, but the actual growing part that's going on is like painful and gangly and awkward and kind of messy and sticky and whatever else. So that was really something that I had to be okay with and give myself some slack.
I really liked how you brought up the point and where if somebody really is apologizing and that their behavior changes, like that is a good indication that it's not weaponizing their quest for forgiveness.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I mean, you don't even, if I screw up and I know I've hurt someone, I will go to them and tell them that I am deeply sorry. And I might ask them, is there a way that I can make it up to you? I specifically do not ask for forgiveness. And I don't even like to use the word forgive because it's so heavily laden with religious. Oh, I don't want anything to do with religion. So I really try not to talk about or use the word forgiveness.
It also puts all the way on the other person, really.
Yes.
Because the other person needs to forgive you. You just need to stand there and ask for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So I love that you say that, because that does motivate like behavioral change. I feel like so many people in my life have said sorry and then no change to behavior. So it's like, well, if you're not going to change your behavior, what is the point in you saying you're sorry? Like, it's not, you could have been that sorry.
Yes. And the other thing, so I told you, you don't have to forgive people. Your parents are in your life by invitation only. My train got derailed. It was really, really good too. Sorry, you'll have to tune in next week or next time I'm back.
So one of the things that I've also kind of grew up with is people telling me that if I don't forgive people, that it will do damage to me, like it'll eat away at me. And so I kind of took that as like, okay, in order to protect myself and I guess be healthy, I should forgive people. What are some of your thoughts about that?
I think to protect yourself and be healthy, you need to be making choices for your own health. Not making choices to make other people happy, but actually choosing in your own best interest. And piggybacking on that is the third thing that I just remembered. There's no prize for being a martyr. There's no prize for being a martyr. So if you're in a relationship with someone, a friendship with someone, whatever it is, and they keep betraying you, it's time to wake up. And it's time to grow up and take an honest look, an honest appraisal of that relationship. There truly is no prize for being a martyr. You get one life. This is the life that you're given. And you can either spend it trapped and miserable because you feel like you have to keep forgiving this, you know, awful person or their awful behavior. You don't. You're not a tree. You can get up and move. You can go somewhere else. You can end the relationship. You can, you know, reach out to a therapist, talk to someone to try and get your stuff figured out. And it may be, if you're in an abusive relationship, you might have to really take the time and be careful and plan out an exit strategy, you know, develop a safety plan. If you're in an abusive situation, then it's really important to be careful and try and plan it outright to the safest bet that you can. But most of us aren't in that situation. But I want you to know there's no price for being a martyr. You get to choose how you're going to live your life and who you're going to live with.
You know, what's interesting is like martyrs in religion are so incredibly celebrated. Like saints are made out of martyrs and people revere these saints. So what you're saying is really in direct conflict to so much of what I learned in growing up in religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the church has a vested interest in keeping people satisfied with crappy situations. Because as soon as you start going, wait a minute, I'm worth more than this. I'm not going to put up with this. I want more for my life. Then they're going to be running for the doors to leave the religion. And then there's no money that's coming in anymore. And no one's there to be worshiping the narcissist or however it goes. So yeah, no, sainthood, totally overrated. Just live your life instead and live your life the way that you want to live it.
So, you know, you talked a lot about your kind of what your struggle was at the beginning of the discussion. You talked about your struggle. Did you have some sort of like path that you took, or was this kind of just something that you stumbled along? Like what did you get out of all of the struggles that you had?
The my therapy practice and the divorcing religion workshop and the conference on religious trauma were all essentially forged in the crucible of heartache. Losing my faith, losing my marriage and my identity, and then, you know, some subsequent losses that went along with that. It really made me try and evaluate what is important in my life, what is important to me. Because when we're in the church or involved in religion, we're meaning seekers. We're always like, well, you know, what's the meaning for that? What's God's meaning for that? And when we mature and we're able to move beyond religion, we become meaning makers. We're no longer a meaning seeker. We're meaning makers. I now am making the meaning in my life. What is meaningful to me is to help other people who are in a tough transition out of religion. They're transitioning into secular life. And I know about that because I have experience in that. So I can share what I've learned with them. I've transitioned from being a meaning seeker to a meaning maker. It's a huge position of empowerment to be in. And I encourage everybody to start thinking in that way.
Yeah, I think that one of the big mistakes that kind of kept me in this bad relationship with my own father was like not thinking about myself, not seeking after kind of what made me happy, but mm-hmm. staying miserable out of an expectation that other people had of me, or that this fantasy family view had of me, and kind of letting go. I felt like what you were just talking about, more powerful. I felt more at peace and happy. Yeah, I could say that.
Yeah.
I could definitely say that. I felt happier without him in my life. Mm-hmm. And I became a stronger person because of it. But if you had to do it again, Janice, would you go through that trauma and that pain to kind of get the benefits out of it?
I think I would. Because I feel like I don't know that I would be exactly where I am today if I hadn't gone through all of those. And I really like where I am today. It's mm-hmm. It's not perfect. And maybe by other people's standards, maybe someone else might think it's not even great, but for me, it's really great. It's exciting. I'm proud of myself when I look at the things that I've overcome. Last year was really, really hard for me. Maybe the hardest year of my whole life, having to cope with so many losses one after another. And I'm still here and I'm making my way up back to the top of that, back to the top of that mountain. And it's all, I'm going to keep it all in my back pocket for when the next thing comes along, when I get knocked down again, because I know I will, and I'll be able to get up again because I'll remember these things that I've triumphed over.
Yeah. It seems like kind of the way that we were looking at what you went through at like a 30,000 view. Like obviously when you were in it, you had no idea what you were going to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And so kind of, if I was putting myself in your shoes, like, or even in a similar situation, the risk of not getting these kinds of great things out of it. Like if I went all through this and didn't have anything to show for it, that seems kind of scary to me. And depressing as well. But you talked about kind of making meaning out of it. Mm-hmm. Is that something even healthy to do after you're kind of coming through this trauma?
When we talk about grief or look at grief counseling, when someone has lost somebody, one way that actually healing and growth and forward movement happens is by giving meaning to the tragedy. And that's what I have done. I have turned my tragedy into a way to help other people with the Divorce and Religion workshop. And now with the conference on religious trauma, it can be really healing and helpful for us if we can do that. I mean, it's true that like a terrible thing happened, that whatever happened was just a really terrible thing. And, you know, maybe I didn't deserve it. And so I could just sit with it in that, you know, heaviness and really be sad about it, which does happen for a time. Or I can try and use it for a springboard as best I can. And that's what resilience looks like. And it's not necessarily an easy thing to do at all. And it takes some people a very long time.
Mm-hmm. And what other productive ways are there to transform that trauma and that bad experiences into something healing and something useful? Because obviously not everyone can set up a workshop and a full-on course like you have, which is absolutely amazing. But do you have any other methods of transforming that trauma into something better?
I think being willing to do honest appraisals and take honest inventories of ourselves and look at the situation that we've come out of. And so even though it is a loss, because transition always involves loss, losing something, there is always some kind of gain too, even though it may be really, sometimes we're in too much pain and we can't see that, what the potential gain is. But being able to do that is very helpful. And sometimes, again, that's where we might reach out to someone else if we feel stuck and we can't really see anything good that's come of it or that could come of it. Asking someone who's not so emotionally invested in it and struggling so much, they might be able to give us some answers. Also, again, do research. Try and figure out what's important to you and what. So we're retrieving the threads of meaning and purpose and trying to bring those things forward into our new life. What did I like about my life before? Is there any way that I can bring that with me into this new life? It is possible. And actually, it can be a fun exercise to do those things. And not everybody is ready to do it right now. People aren't ready until they're ready.
I love that. Thank you. And we are approaching the Q&A session now. So do you have any last things, any last topics that you want to cover or any last sentences? Because you usually bring a few helpful sentences at the end of the session.
I wrote down one more because I thought it was just so true. Life does not necessarily get easier or more forgiving, but we get stronger and more resilient. That's by Steve Maraboli. And I like that. I think as we go through life and we grow through life and we're accumulating all these experiences, hopefully they're all adding to our resilience and we're getting stronger. And we see that we've made it through everything so far. And we have some pretty good skills that can get us through whatever we're going through now.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to say, but going through some of these issues that I have had in my own life, it's weird. But once I began kind of taking on, like I did this, and my friends helped me out to do this. I still have these difficult times that I go through, but I can kind of look back in the past and say, hey, I got through this. I got some good things out of it. I think I can get through the current situation. I just have to keep my head. I have to kind of steel myself that this is going to be tough, but I will be better for it on the other side. That's kind of how I'm approaching it these days, just based on some of the shit that I went through in the past.
Yes, and our idea of success may change as well as we mature and as we go through different things. So when I was in my 20s, you know, what I thought would be a great success and what I would judge for myself as being a great success now are very, very different things. So be open to adapt those things and jettison old ways of thinking and adapt new ways of thinking.
You mean we're not like stones that whatever is etched into us at the beginning, we have to keep through the rest of our life?
Nope.
All right.
The joy of autonomy.
Janice, thank you so much. God damn it, this was so good. And I'm looking at the chat, and a lot of people got a lot out of it too. And awesome. I can tell you that I personally got a lot out of it for myself. So thank you so, so much for doing this today.
You are very welcome. And if anyone's interested in the Divorcing Religion workshop, I usually do it as a 6-week online group series, but I am going to be selling the workbook by itself. I'm not able to do the group work right now because I'm working so hard on putting the conference together. So you can go to my website, divorcing-religion.com, and you can find out more.
Well, we have a few questions. Got some time to have us ask you some questions?
Ooh, I'm always nervous about the question, but I'll do my best. I'll put my lips back on here. Okay. All right, I'm ready.
All right. One of the first questions that we had kind of went back to you talking about how you didn't have the skill, you weren't given the skills from your religion or from your past religion or your family that you grew up in. What kind of skills did you need during those tough times that you didn't get? The one you talked about that I heard of was dealing with grief and loss. Do you have any others that you can think of off the top of your head?
I don't think that I was really taught to be self-reliant. Growing up a female in a very fundamentalist church, I was taught to be reliant on God and on my father and on whoever I might marry. Basically just to be reliant on men. And so I hadn't really had to develop that skill myself. And so that's been a learning curve And I'm 51 years old now, and I am still coming up against things that I haven't done before, and they seem like very basic things maybe for some folks, but I haven't had the opportunity to do them, or I've been too scared to do them. And so now at this stage in my life, I'm ready to start embracing some of those things. And the internet is fantastic. You can learn how to do pretty much anything you will ever need to learn by, you know, YouTube or whatever. And of course, reach out to other people too, who have more experience.
So it sounds like dealing with grief and loss was one, and then being self-reliant, like being able to trust yourself and mm-hmm. take care of yourself was another skill. Mm-hmm. And there was another one too that I miss about just like experiencing some, I don't know, maybe not. Sorry. All right, Amaya, you want to ask the next one?
Yeah. So someone was asking, what are other words for forgiveness? So I guess in the sense of healthier alternatives or better alternatives to the word forgiveness that we could use in these circumstances.
Right. Okay, sure. Yes, that's a great question. I tell people that acceptance is far more important mm-hmm. than forgiveness. So we must accept the reality of what has happened. So somebody has harmed us or betrayed us or whatever in some way, that is a true thing that has actually happened. If we're going to continue on a pathway of healing and growth, we have to accept that that terrible thing did happen to us. We can't just pretend it didn't happen and, you know, keep pushing it under the rug. Acceptance is what's important, not forgiveness. And so when I speak to clients, I speak to them in terms of acceptance.
And on the other end too, earlier in the discussion, I heard you mention that instead of you going to someone and asking their forgiveness, what you said was, what can I do to make this better?
Yes,
and I loved that. I loved that.
Oh, good. Yes. I apologize. I own my behavior. I own the mistake that I've made, whatever I've done that's harmed this person or has caused a breach in the relationship. And my aim is to repair that breach, to repair the relationship. And what I think might do it might actually miss the mark, might not be what would be important to the other person. And since they're the one that I've wounded, they're the one that I'm going to ask, how can I make this right?
Yeah, thank you so much.
So we've got another question here. Let's say that there's someone who has wronged us and we're still kind of struggling to either accept that this is what happened or grant forgiveness. What are some of your thoughts and kind of what do you think it does internally for us if that person passes away and we don't have an opportunity mm-hmm. to deal with it? Like they're no longer in our lives. So where we can face what's happened, what's going
on. That's a real thing that definitely does happen. And particularly I'm thinking of people who've grown up in abusive home situations and then the abuser dies. And the abuser has maybe never, ever expressed a shred of remorse for having done the horrible things that they've done to the person. And I would say definitely reach out to a qualified secular therapist in that case, because it is grief work that you'll be doing. And there are, you know, there are different things that we can do. We can write a note to the deceased and tell them exactly what we think of their shitty behavior. We can I actually went to a cemetery and read my note to an angel because I was so angry at God, at Jesus. Like, and I know now that those things, they don't exist, but I had to get it out. I was so heartbroken and so wounded that I spent my entire life believing this. And who could I read it to? So I just went and found like an angel statue in the cemetery and read my letter and then ripped up my letter and got rid of it. There are ceremonies that we can do that can help us with the releasing of that, or even talking if the therapist is in one chair and they're acting as the deceased parent or the deceased person. And then you can have a chance to have that conversation with a healthy person and get some potential emotional resolution that way. That is such a great question. I'm glad that somebody asked that.
I'm really glad that you kind of identified grief and as being a part of that too, because that's something I had never considered either, how both we are dealing with the past trauma that has happened to us, but then there's this loss of an opportunity to kind of rectify it. That's fantastic. I never thought about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice. Someone else asks if you have any advice on existing with a partner who expects recovery to just happen without their own input.
There's partner A and partner B, and maybe is partner B unwilling to own or participate in like acknowledging that they've done something wrong?
I'm not sure if it's so much about forgiveness, but more that someone is trying to recover, but they're not willing to put the effort to recover. So they're just kind of like waiting, they're expecting, you know, that recovery to happen, I believe, if I understood you correctly. But yeah, correct me if I'm wrong in the chat. That's how I got it.
Recovery does take active work. And frankly, we're not ready until we're ready. We may want to be ready. But there are stages of readiness for change, for making change. And we have to be in that place. It's like someone say they should quit smoking because smoking is bad for them, but they may be in what we call pre-contemplative. They don't care. They're just going to keep smoking. They don't care. And then they have to go get to another stage where they're thinking, well, I don't like how much it's costing me or the way it smells or whatever problem they have with it. And that moves them one step closer on the stages of change. So there are stages that we have to go through before we're actually ready to do the work. And I hope for everyone that if you are partnered right now, that your partner is extremely supportive of you in changes that you are wanting to make in your life.
Mm-hmm. And what about if you think someone else should ask you for forgiveness, but they don't, and instead they pretend like nothing happened?
Right. Okay. That's a good one too. We have to be careful not to slip into passive aggressive behavior here, because that's really easy to do, but it's never helpful, and it's not really a mature thing to do. If you feel like you have been wronged by someone, it is up to you to talk to that person respectfully and calmly and let them know, when you did this, you know, here's how I felt about that. Here's how I perceived it. Because we also need to find out, maybe we are perceiving the situation incorrectly. Maybe they really actually meant to say something else, or they just forgot, or whatever it is. So we want to make sure that our vision is clear, that we're seeing the situation for what it actually is. And then you've explained to them how it made you feel. And the ball is somewhat in their court. What are they going to do about it? Are they going to apologize or not? And if they just say, well, you know, I don't think I did anything wrong, and I think you're the one with the problem, that is a time to take a look at your relationship and look for patterns. Has this happened before? Is this a regular occurrence with this person, or is it a one-off? Because sometimes, you know, somebody does have a bad day, or we're just going to have to agree to disagree. But if you are the one that is constantly having to apologize, or if you are the one that's constantly feeling wronged, you need to stop and take a an honest look, a good appraisal of the relationship, and see if it's healthy and right for you to remain in relationship with that person.
I love that. Yeah, and it's so difficult to do. If that person is your partner or a family member or someone that, you know, is close to you, it's just so difficult to go through that process of really thinking, is this person right for me and my life? Is it contributing to my mental health, or is it doing the opposite thing? So for anyone who is dealing with that, oh my God, I'm so sorry. It's so difficult. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Janice.
It is a really, it's a tricky situation to be in, because once we come to certain realizations, we may then have to take steps to end the relationship. It can mean a painful ending, but again, there can be a great beginning just on the other side of it.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. Got one other. We got a couple of questions about coping with grief and uncertainty. We're going to drop a link to the talk we had about grief back in the summer of last year into the chat. But we also have another question here. And this is kind of, I think, goes beyond just in religion. But when people kind of think back on their experiences, and they tend to think like, well, maybe it wasn't that bad. Maybe I could still kind of go back someday, whether it's talking about their own religion or whether it's talking about relationships. Like if I were to say, maybe my father wasn't as bad as I thought he was, maybe I overreacted. What kind of advice or what kind of thoughts do you have on people dealing with those doubts and questions?
Sometimes when I've had a very painful ending to a relationship, and I mean particularly a romantic relationship, I have actually gone to the trouble of writing down every awful thing that I can remember that that person did to me, said to me, horrible situations they put me in, because I'm pretty sure that down the road I might get wobbly and think about, oh, you know, maybe life was better with that person. That's part of being human. We do have doubts, we do second guess. It can be helpful either to write those things down or talk with a friend who has seen you go through this over and over again with this person, and that friend can sometimes help be a bit of a guidepost when that goes on. But you know, you're autonomous. You get to make your own choices. If a few years later you decide, you know what, I actually would prefer, and I think that person was better, and maybe I misjudged them, whatever, you're allowed to do whatever you want to do. I hope you'll be real careful if you've got kids, because they just kind of unfortunately get dragged with us hither and yon wherever we go and whoever we hitch ourselves to. So do keep those things in mind.
That's great. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.